But I remember I was here, I was a greenie, and the fire was, and some of my sister-in-law's friends got burned there. A lot of people got burned. The Triangle, the name of the company was the Triangle Fire. In Europe, they heard about it. I remember my parents wrote me a letter. Gehört hat, sie gewann ein größer Feier in New York. Die Kinder sind in der Reich. It was a terrible thing. A lot of people got burned. Got burned without recognition, some of them.
New York, March 26, 1911. More than 100 workers, most of them women and young girls, were killed in a fire yesterday afternoon, which gutted the 10-story building at the northwest corner of Washington Place and Green Street, just off Washington Square.
Women machine operators at the Triangle Waste Company jumped from the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors in groups of twos or threes into life nets.
Their bodies spun downward from the high windows of the building, so close together that the few nets stretched below were soon broken.
The firemen and passersby who helped hold them were crushed to the pavement by the rain of falling bodies.
The soft thud of the blazing bodies sickened onlookers and made them turn away, ill with horror.
It was learned that the proprietors were in the habit of locking all doors after 8 a.m. in order to keep their employees at work.
That meant no escape for the terror-stricken girls.
Down, down they fell.
First 25 were reported dead, then 40, then 50, then 100, then 200. No one could tell last night how big the death roll was.
The firemen seemed to be dazed.
They fumbled while screaming girls hurtled down to the pavement below.
There were no fire escapes in the front of the building.
The fire department hoses failed to reach the upper floors.
No words can begin to convey the horror of the scene.
This is but an attempt to indicate what happened.
The young women jumping from the top floors of the Triangle Company were shirtwaist makers. They were workers in New York City's garment industry, an industry which had doubled its production and workforce in the 10 years before 1911. Subject to the whims of fashion and intense competition, the industry was one of extremes. Small sweatshops and large factories, rich manufacturers and shoestring contractors, enormous volume and minutely specialized work. A shirtwaist worker's job was seasonal. She worked 8 months and was laid off four. If she was a skilled machine operator, she might make $10 to $12 for a 56-hour week, although many young girls made only three or four. On these wages, she was tenuously self-sufficient and often supported parents or sent money to a family in Europe. She walked 30 minutes to work, joined a dramatic club for a dime a month, slept in a boarder's alcove, but spent most of her time bent over her machine, making shirtwaists, garments worn by fashionable women and made from a sheer cotton fabric more combustible than paper. A few young men made waists, but regardless of sex, nearly all were recent immigrants, mostly Jewish and Italian. The shirtwaist trade was built on these young, usually unmarried men and women, 30,000 of them by 1911. For them, America meant the canyons of Lower Broadway, and after finding their first job, it meant one job after another.
I came from Kiev over here. I was all alone, so I came here to make a living. When I came over here, I went in a place where they do sewing. Mm-hmm. So I went into ladies' waist makers. I went up to the Triangle shop to work. There was waist.
What did you do for them? Were you an operator or a finisher?
No, an operator.
An operator? Were you always an operator?
Always.
How did you come to start working there?
Somebody told me about it. They need operators, and I had to leave one shop that I didn't make enough.
So you just walked in and they hired you?
They hired me, yes. Mm-hmm. They asked me how much I would know and all that. I said I worked there and all that. And I came up that there I made $7 a week and you gave me $9 a week. So to me it was a lot of money at that time. So I sat down to work.
Where did you start to work?
In a Triangle Shirtwaist Company.
And what did you do there?
It wasn't a very, very difficult task, rather monotonous. You see, when the operators finish sewing the body of the shirtwaist on the machine, there's some threads left, and we youngsters were to cut off the threads with little scissors.
How old were you then?
Oh, probably 8, 9, I don't know.
Yeah, we were... on our tables, young people, all of them young people, boys and girls.
The Triangle Waste Company was one of the industry's largest in a time when large shops were being forced out of the trade. But business was good in March 1911, and the season was at its peak. The shop, owned by Isaac Harris and Max Blank, had only recently expanded to the top three floors of the 10-story loft at 23 Washington Place. They employed 600 young people, mostly on the 8th and 9th floors. The building itself was designated fireproof by the city, meaning only that its walls were lined with asbestos. Each floor had only two stairways, one on Green Street and one on Washington Place. There were two small passenger elevators on the Washington Place side and two larger freight elevators exiting on Green Street. Employees were instructed to use the freight elevators. To prevent overcrowding, factory law required a certain amount of airspace per worker, but Triangle's high ceilings allowed enough airspace to comply with the law, while the floor space could be filled to the maximum. Each floor was like a fireproof box, tightly packed with tinder.
Linen, linen, miles of linen, stitching, stitching, cutting, pinning, with no end and no beginning. That's the song of the sewing machine. Sewing, sewing, ever sewing, going nowhere, always going, growing older, without growing. That's the song of the sewing machine. Tears, tears, and yet more tears. Nights that last a thousand years, heartaches for my souvenirs. What am I doing, and what does it mean?
There were three long rows of machines. In addition, there were cutters, examiners, finishers, and us kids. Well, the cutters and finishers and the operators faced the windows. They had to have the light. Others, like button sewers, button hole makers, even some finishers, they were not facing the light at all, you know.
Did you ever see the boss or know who they were?
Yes. Oh, sure. I mean, see, it was so many times the boss.
Sure. What were they like?
My man, he didn't mingle with the crowd. He just came in, we knew who he is, but he was never mingled with the crowd and all that, you know. The foreman was good enough. He was loyal, very loyal to the boss, not to the workers.
Did you ever have any occasion to meet Blank or Harris or anyone in the management?
Well, they were walking around watching you all the time.
Both the bosses, too?
You saw them, which is different than meeting them. They won't talk to us. Oh, no. But they slicked around to see that you were not talking to the rest of the girls. They were walking around all the time, all day long. Mm-hmm. You see, Blank was a tall, heavy-set man. Harris was short. Later on, they reminded you of Mutt and Jeff, you know.
Right. Was your foreman considered a hard one or...
A very bad one. Bitch, a slave driver. Actually, he didn't let you to breed straight. He was on the floor, not with one, but a few of them, because the shop was too big for one man.
We youngsters thought that they were the meanest people on earth. In the first place, they didn't mind exploiting the children. We usually started at $1.50 a week. From 7:30 in the morning until all hours in the evening in the busy season, no overtime pay. You were washed when you went to the toilet, not to stay longer than they thought you should, regardless of how you felt. They were just, I think, the worst possible human beings that we encountered at that time.
This is From the Vault, presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information or to order a copy of this program, call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to our program.
You know, lunch hour. We used to take out our sandwiches and sit down. And
where did you sit?
We sometimes we sit near the machine. Sometimes we used to go in the, you know, when those where they had a little bit more money, they used to go out in the restaurants and the, you know, have a sandwich and a cup of coffee and all that. We used to bring a hard-boiled egg, a roll, a fruit, an apple. Well, we were sitting in a group, or whatever we had together, you know. And the group, the girls and the boys, we used to sit and talk and eat. A girl used to tell she went out and she had an engagement, and then this woman had a ring, and this one, the young people used to tell, and they're going to school, and they can up the language, and they want to be this, and they want to be that. Not to remain as an operator for his future. When we had to go home, we had to be examined.
Who examined you?
A girl, standing and examined me, my bosom, my bag, and my pockets. If I didn't have no lace or cotton or a blouse or something to put it in, even in the bosom she used to look in, and the same thing the man too.
They usually had a man there at the freight elevator. They didn't use the passenger elevator, you weren't allowed to. But they usually saw that you have nothing. But they were there to see whether or not you do have anything.
We never had a shop meeting to come and give the complaints what's going on, that we have to be examined and they should put it in our hands and our bosom. This was a disgrace. Our being was a disgrace. We had never had a meeting on that.
There were union members in the Triangle shop.
Yes.
You were a union member then?
Of course. I was the first one that came in there before I went in there.
And there was a shop lady?
There was a chairman in the shop, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I had very little power at that time. Very little power, because shop was too big. They were too powerful, and you couldn't do much.
Well, the smaller factories, as natural, I suppose, were kindlier to the employees. They were not as big as the Triangle Waste Company. They were not as rich as the Triangle Waste Company. And when you were a poor contractor or a poor small manufacturer, you really don't mind associating employees, you see.
Did you know, when you were working there, did you know where the fire escape was?
I vaguely remember the fire escape, vaguely, because we never saw it as far, but they say that it was.
But you don't remember seeing one?
No.
No one ever explained to you how to leave the building in case of a fire?
No.
It was on a Saturday, 4 o'clock. We used to stay in the lion and keep our backs like this here. And the four ladies used to pass by and look in to check up if we take something to go. And then while we were standing in the line, the fire started. And the fire started and we couldn't go out anymore. The doors used to be inside. When we want to go out, we couldn't go out. When the fire engine came, they broke up the door. I was the first one by the door. And my clothes had to boil.
Rose Reiner looked at herself briefly in the mirror, straightened her hat, and left the 8th floor dressing room late that Saturday afternoon. She started across the floor, crowded with her fellow workers, full of quitting time talk and weekend plans. She heard a shout. It was Eva Harris. There's a fire. Rose saw the smoke rising from the tables near the Green Street windows. A line of hanging waste patterns began to burn and fall on the fabric underneath them. The cutters jumped onto the tables and tried to tear the patterns from the line, but now burning scraps seemed to be flying everywhere. On the 9th floor, the vibrating machines were just becoming quiet. On the 10th floor, owner Max Blank was calling a cab for his 2 small daughters.
Back on the eighth floor, Samuel Bernstein, Triangle's manager, heard Rose Reiner scream and saw that the buckets of water on hand were useless against the quickly spreading flames. The fire, feeding on wicker baskets full of thread and fabric, was quickly closing off the Green Street side of the shop. Bernstein yelled to his foreman, Lewis Brown, "Get the girls out!" The young women rushed to the Washington Place door and to the elevators. In terror, they watched the cars ascend to the floors above them without stopping. Brown struggled with the lock on the door, finally wrenching it open. Through the smoke and the struggling, fainting women, he saw Dina Lifshitz frantically trying to reach the 10th floor switchboard by telephone. She screamed, "Fire! Fire!" but didn't know if anyone was listening. At last, the girls pushed and tore their way down the Washington Place stairs, meeting the first fireman from Company 72. "Look out, girls," one shouted. "They're beginning to jump from above." "We can't go out," Sylvia Riegler called. "We might be killed by them jumping." Already, the eighth floor windows were bursting from the heat.
On the 10th floor, Mary Alter's switchboard buzzed. She heard shouts, confusion, and then Dina's scream of, "Fire, fire, there's a fire on the 8th floor." A bookkeeper named Levine put in a call to the fire department. Max Blank rang from the shipping room to his partner. He yelled, "To the roof! It's too late to go down!" Clerks, pattern makers, secretaries, and Blank's daughters crowded to the roof ladder. No one telephoned the 9th floor.
The flames from the floor below appeared so suddenly to the girls on the 9th floor that for a moment there was silence among them. In twos and threes among the rows of oiled machines and in groups near the dressing room, the young people fell silent as the afternoon light dimmed with smoke, and now they could hear the screams of their friends beneath them. Anna Gulo was carried along with the crowd, pushing toward the closed Washington Place exit. She found herself at the door and pulled with all her strength. It was locked. Already the open Green Street door was curtained with fire. On the other side of the shop, Nellie Ventura remembered the fire escape. With three or four other women, she managed to push open the window and climb over the waist-high sill to the metal platform. Below was the small enclosed courtyard in the rear. Large metal shutters blocked the ladder going down. Nellie and a friend finally swung them clear and started to climb down. Above them, Abe Gordon, a button sewer, jumped over the sill himself and started down. He felt the flimsy skeleton of the escape begin to shake. More girls were coming down after him. He stepped back into the building at the 6th floor and still had one foot on the escape when it gave way. A tangle of women and metal plunged to the brick beneath. Fire raced along the rows of machines where only 10 minutes before the young women and men had cut the last threads of the day. Now one group of workers was trapped against the Washington Place door and a second group was scattered among the rows. The fire backed them to the windows. They turned first toward the windows, then away, then back again. Someone jumped. Then another balanced on the edge and stepped off. Outside, a fireman said, "We thought there were bundles of cloth."
Women struggled against each other to squeeze into the small elevators. Sarah Kammerstein pushed herself against the crowded car and looked desperately for her sister. She saw her trapped among the tables. But someone shoved her into the car and the doors closed. She never saw her sister alive again. Now there was no exit. The flames were sucked into the shaft and up the Green Street stairwell. The Washington Place door lock held fast.
In the street below, the crowd watched helplessly as the girls plummeted from the building. As they watched, a young man helped a girl to the windowsill on the 9th floor. He held her out deliberately, away from the building, and let her go. He held out a second girl the same way and let her drop. Neither of the girls resisted, but appeared almost hopeful. The young man helped another girl to the ledge. They kissed, and he held her for an instant in space and dropped her. Without hesitating and without looking down, he took off his coat, set it neatly on the edge, and jumped. Pump companies drenched the building with tons of water. Soon no one appeared at the windows. The screams were gone. There was only the sound of the crowd and the waterfalls cascading from every window.
Sure, I remember. I worked there one day.
In Triangle?
Triangle. Just one day before the fire. I went up to work there. When I came there and I looked at the building, I didn't like it. Why, it looked like a little prison, dark. You couldn't see the stairs. It was terrible. So I worked one day, and the next day I got my period, so I couldn't go to work. I was sick. And that's the reason I was lucky that I wasn't there when the fire broke out. You see, I didn't like it. Well, how did I work there? One of my two girls were friends, two sisters. They took me up there. They got burned.
About 2 weeks or so before the fire, I was sent up to work there through a friend of mine. And they had a two-week trial period. And after my 2 weeks were up, they didn't like my work. It wasn't good enough for them. And they sent me away. But even then, we noticed that after all the workers came in to work in the morning, all the doors were locked, the windows were locked, so that there was no exit to the fire escapes or anything like that.
And at that time, when I came over to him, that was on Friday.
Who did you go over to?
To the foreman, that he was on the floor. And I came over to him and I told him I can't work overtime tonight. And he came into temper and he said, get out. And don't come in tomorrow. And I went out, and I didn't come in tomorrow, and I was alive tomorrow. I would be among 146 victims there, just the same as they've been.
It was in the springtime, the windows were open, and we could all hear it, but the way the boys announced, Triangle fire, so many people's lives were lost. And everybody that lived in New York, and everybody that lived in this country, as a matter of fact, knew the following day what happened here.
But it was on a Saturday afternoon, and I stood near the statue of Giuseppe Garibaldi, and I watched that, and I saw even the flames then. The building was in flames. I could see the flame, I could see smoke. I didn't see them jumping, but I know they did. A lot of them were killed inside from the fire. That's why they couldn't recognize him at that time.
I just can't remember. I came there, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon because I was waiting for my cousin. I was supposed to go up Monday to work. And when I saw the fire from 8th floor and 9th floor, and I saw that they were throwing out bundles through the window, through the fire escape, I didn't know that the people were throwing it out. I was supposed to meet her 4 o'clock Saturday in the afternoon.
Where were you going to meet her?
On Washington Park, just across from that building.
And she never came?
She never came. She was buried with 15 people on Mount Zion Cemetery.
How long had your cousin been working at Triangle?
I think about a year already. And she was supposed to get married on next Sunday. She was 20 years old. Celia Rifkin.
I worked till 1 o'clock at that time. It was not a union shop, but we worked out half a day. And when I walked out from the shop, I saw the flames, such a thick smoke you couldn't see anything. So I thought, in New York, fire is a fire. So I went home, and then I heard there was a distant relative of mine, a young man who was a shipping clerk, and he was lucky to jump out from a window, and he came home, he came running home, parents at the time lived on the east side. And the minute he came in the room, he opened the door, so he fell down the floor and he fainted that time.
We were all running to the building and all that. Oh, it was terrible. Everybody was around, we couldn't get there. Everybody was screaming, motors were running in the building, in the fire. And all that. It was a terrible tragedy.
And when the fire broke out, everybody got excited, but the girl that came down, the younger sister, was so strong, she didn't lose herself, and she pulled down the older sister, and they're both saved.
Since I remember myself, I'm still crying. And I went up upstairs, in the 10th floor just a week before the fire. I came there, I had a cousin of mine. She came from Vilna. And I didn't know, but I didn't see her, but he told me where she's working. I came up upstairs and I saw the foreman didn't let me in the shop. You have to go in the shop, you have to ring a bell. And he opened the door and he asked, what do you want? I told him I want to see this girl. He says, come at lunchtime to eat lunch. And then lunch, I didn't know, came there. I went away, I went home, I saw her after. But she got killed, jumped from the 10th floor. I heard Halden screaming.